Hey everyone, welcome back to Manual Therapy Forum. And today on this podcast, we're going to get to talk with Shirley Sauerman. A number of you probably have heard of Shirley Sauerman. She's been around physical therapy for a number of years, certainly, but she is really well known for movement systems impairment syndromes. She's been faculty member and instructor at Washington University in St. Louis for quite a long time, but recently retired the past few years. But she's still extremely active within the profession, and she's been great at publishing research, and she even has a couple of books that's been published that point out, you know, the movement system impairment syndromes for the body. And that was one of the reasons why I wanted to talk to her, is even though she may not be a strict manual therapist like we might typically think of someone, she definitely has input into how the body operates and how the body operates efficiently, and has her own perspective. And there may be some disagreements that some people have with her perspective, as she may disagree with other people about their perspective. But that's one of the reasons why I wanted to speak with her, to kind of get a better understanding of what that was. And honestly, it's not what I thought it was. I was thinking one thing, and she was nice to point out that what her thinking really is, or what her opinions really are. And it was just different from my expectation. Not in a bad way, not in a good way, it was just different. So I'm glad that I did get to talk with her to get a better understanding about that. So I hope that all of you enjoy that as well. Please enjoy this podcast like we mentioned. If you want to share it, that would be great. One other cool thing about this particular podcast and all the other ones after this one, we are also on Spotify now, as well as Apple Podcast and Stitcher. I'm even working on trying to get it on Google Play. I just have to figure out how to do that. So sooner or later, I hope to have that as well. Like all the other podcasts, if you guys enjoy this one, please share that with some friends and colleagues. You can share it over on social media as well. I'm on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, just a number of different things. That way people can find out about us and what we're doing. So please do that, and I certainly appreciate it. For now, enjoy this podcast with Shirley, and let us know if you have any questions or comments. I'd certainly appreciate them. Thanks a lot. Talk to you guys later. Okay, everyone, welcome back. Today we're going to be speaking with Dr. Shirley Sauerman. Shirley, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
I'm delighted to have a chance to chat with you, Matt.
So we were just kind of chatting before we started recording, and you were about to go into some history about your background and how, you know, you're about to expand on a topic we were talking about. Can you please continue that thought?
Yes. Actually, I am so old that I started at the end of the polio era. So, and that plays into this whole answering your question, that at those times, even though the vaccine had just come out when I got into PT school, there were still some new cases and there were some residuals. And the big thing of what we did then was worry a lot when the muscles were paralyzed. I didn't realize how easy it was, but that as they would return, become re-innervated, that the stronger muscles would overpull the weaker muscles. So we did this thing called muscle re-education. And that gave me a sense of worry about, well, maybe not all the muscles follow the rules. In fact, I always like to tell people, muscles don't take kinesiology. you learn what they're supposed to do, and then you try and find out when are they ever going to do it that way in the real world. Yeah. So anyway, that was quickly, the polio did go away, and then I was I spent 9 years taking care of neurological patients, and it's really amazing to me, because that was the time in which they were actually just beginning to save the lives of the spinal cord injured and the head injured. They died before. So because people had done so well with the polio patient, we had stroke patients, and they were younger, actually, because hypertension wasn't controlled. So we had young spinal cord injured, young head injured. In fact, I've said this before on such a podcast, but people like you, I'm sure, should be thankful, because in those days, if you were 6 foot tall and rear-ended, you became quadriplegic.
Oh,
because,
yeah.
Because of no seat belts or headrests.
Yeah.
And anyway, so in one of our dilemmas then was trying to understand what we could do for the neurological patient that we shouldn't do, that we did for the polio patient, because, you know, all of a sudden it came out that spasticity was the evil thing, and we can't strengthen them and we can't stretch them because we'll make the spasticity worse. So it was a real time of trying to figure out what should you do, because it certainly wasn't clear mm-hmm. what you do. And being as swift as I am, it only took me 9 years to really admit that I didn't know what I was doing. So, but I learned a lot about, in the kind of muscle reeducation went away. In fact, I became so enamored of the nervous system that I sort of thought nerve innervated bone. Mm-hmm. I completely forgot about the muscles and what they were supposed to do, even though I had been highly schooled in muscle testing, et cetera. And in fact, they had so little to teach that I spent so long in the anatomy lab, I thought I'd never smell right again. we were just, there all the time.
Yeah.
Anyway, I mean, and so that was good. But the idea being that finally after 9 years and knowing that, you know, sometimes people with an upper motor neuron lesion could move their limb correctly when they were sitting still, but then it didn't work when they stood up, or it worked when they sat down, but then it didn't work when they stood up. That mean it was like, oh my God, I'll never get this sorted out. And there happened to be, there was a lot of serendipitous things in my life that I won't go through, but I was very fortunate that there was a neurologist who was also interested in the disordered motor control. Mm-hmm. And I had had a variety of heated discussions with him about how to manage these patients because I was worried about the spasticity. And he said, that's stupid. Nobody needs to worry about that. It's not the problem, et cetera, et cetera. So he took me on then as a PhD student, and I was really not qualified to be a PhD student, but mm-hmm. there I was with severe case of cerebral atrophy and poor preparation. I wish I were making this up, but it's true.
Yeah.
And anyway, and he was in one of the other coincidences. His major lab assistant cohort was a woman who had become a physical therapist, but had never really practiced because she immediately became an assistant to the neurologist. So she was in the lab with me and very, very supportive. And so I spent a long time learning about the nervous system. It took me only 7 years to get my PhD program. In that time, they didn't look on human studies as acceptable. You had to do animal studies. So I rid the world of a lot of cats in my time doing my PhD. Mm. And then they were just at that time when I finished, which was 1973, beginning to record from the motor cortex in awake performing monkeys. So he decided that was the way we were going to uncover the secret of the upper motor neuron syndrome. So we set about starting that kind of work. And he at that time then became department chair. And so it was up to Maggie and I, and we were both about equally prepared for such an undertaking. So we started in training rhesus monkeys, and because of the idea of his experiment, they were trained with the foot. So we trained ankle movements, and then we proceeded to record from their motor cortex. And actually, believe it or not, I did that for about 19 years.
Oh, wow.
Nobody invited me to Sweden for the Nobel Prize. We did not push back many frontiers of ignorance, but I did learn a lot about the nervous system and about how it behaved and about monkeys.
Yeah.
As I had to go every day of the week, Christmas, New Year's, every day, because they had to be taken care of as well as recorded from.
Wow.
Yeah. So it was quite a big deal. And so anyway, that then when I had finished they gave me a job there as a coordinator of the basic sciences. So I taught in both the OT and PT school. They coordinated their basic sciences. Mm-hmm. And then it goes on from there. Then WashU was getting finally their second program director. After all, it started in about, we just had the 75th anniversary 3 years ago.
Oh, wow.
And they finally got a new program director, and that was in 1979, and it was Steve Rose. And Steve was, there were two things that Steve was a very charismatic and very smart guy. He had gotten his PhD from Columbia University, and he did basic science neuromuscular junction, but he was very keen on two things. One was classification, because he saw that as the only way we could be effective, just as medicine recognizes it only by classification of patient problems, also called diagnosis, could we ever have treatment effectiveness. And particularly his interest was in back pain. And so Steve, lacking other people to influence, would drag me in to see these patients with back pain when he was seeing them. And lo and behold, for a variety of reasons, I started giving them the same thing to do that I gave my stroke patients. In other words, I started teaching them to move differently, how to walk differently, I use a quadruped position a lot. Mm-hmm. Now, with the neurological patient, it was to retrain the brain, which was kind of jokey, but anyway, that's what we were doing. And, but I couldn't help but notice all of the mechanical things going on and the muscle behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, so I, for lack of knowing what else to do, I started, giving these patients these same kind of interventions, and they got better. And I'm like, I wonder why. But in contrast to the neurological patient with the upper motor neuron syndrome, there were like rules, like kinesiology and like anatomy, but the nervous system was pretty still kind of like, I don't get how this works. Also at the time, I had become kind of good friends with Florence Kendall. And in fact, I had said something nice about muscle testing at this time, and everybody said, oh, well, you and Florence ought to talk together because you're the only two that thinks muscle testing is worthwhile.
Oh, wow.
This is true. So we had a mutual friend, and I went to meet with Florence about doing a program for the Maryland chapter. This was way back in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And lo and behold, it made me start to realize about her testing. But I had one thing that was different than Florence. What she called that long muscles were weak and short muscles were strong was too much of a generalization. There were some flaws in that as I saw it. Like, for example, if your shoulders in an anterior tilt, then an explanation was you had a long lower trapezius. Well, you know, I didn't think I had to be super strong to posteriorly tilt my scapula.
Mm-hmm.
So like I didn't break a sweat doing that. So it again didn't quite make sense. So, but Florence was a really wordsmith, and she was a very critical thinker. And so she kind of helped me as well as some colleagues to really start thinking through more carefully generalized statements. All of this to say, I'm coming at this from a nervous system thing. I serendipitously have musculoskeletal patients get better when I gave them little fine things to do, and when I try and change how they walked and how they got up from sit to stand, et cetera. Okay. So I didn't fully appreciate that, and I was still trying to work out all the things that I saw. It was sort of a case of looking at the forest versus the trees. And then remembering back to the old muscle reeducation thing, I thought, golly, I wonder if you don't need polio to have a problem with strong muscles overpulling weak muscles.
Mm-hmm.
And that became sort of a basis. And this thing with Florence is, to give you an example of how this goes, it's something that everybody kind of observes but didn't think it through long enough, I guess, is it would be if somebody was sitting and they extended their knee and they got a posterior pelvic tilt, that was a sign that the hamstrings were too short. Well, if I would take that same person and keep their pelvis from tilting, I could fully extend their knee. And I'm like, well, then the hamstrings aren't too short. I wonder why the pelvis posteriorly tilted.
Mm-hmm.
So other people would have just, they just went away with, well, that's what the problem is. The hamstrings are too short. And to me, it was, they can't, that can't be the cause, because it shouldn't happen until you get to the end of the muscle length. And number two, it's happening in people that don't have short hamstrings.
Right.
So now Florence just immediately labeled that as bad muscle assessment, sloppy testing.
Yeah, you didn't measure it correctly.
Yeah, right. You didn't keep the pelvis still to measure it correctly. And she was right. And the other people were making an assumption, but that was the important observation, because that was laid the foundation for me, is for, oh my gosh, this part is moving when it shouldn't be moving, and it's not because the muscle's short. It just moves too readily. Are you with me at all?
Yeah.
Okay. So that became sort of the basis of, I kept trying to figure that out and how it played into the patient's syndromes.
So I'm sorry, Shirley, can I word that differently just to make sure that I understand it correctly and listeners would understand it too?
Mm-hmm.
So what you were just saying, are you basically saying that they're recruiting their hamstrings incorrectly or in a...
No.
Okay, so I just want to make sure that I got you there.
I do. I want you to do that, you know, because I think I understand what I have to say, but not making it clear.
So it's not that they're recruiting in a poor movement pattern or at a poor habit. Like, so what? How else would you word that?
It goes, it's fallen into what we now explain as a relative stiffness problem.
Okay.
So muscles have spring-like properties.
Yes.
And then the spring being a change in tension per unit change in length.
Okay.
So what that means is that when they are activating their quadriceps to extend their knee, in fact, if they activated their hamstrings, some people do, but it's not that the hamstrings are just doing that, but it tells you that the pull on the hamstrings is, they're stiffer than the back extensors.
Okay.
So the spring that's the least stiff gives.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yep. So, and you can do the same thing when people are prone and you passively flex their knee, they'll get lumbopelvic rotation. And that's because usually it's the tensor fascia lata is stiffer than the abdominals and the back is too flexible. So you've gotten too much flexibility in the back.
Mm-hmm.
And the springs, any kind of little tug, it's more an item of the excessive flexibility. And usually these are accessory motion flexibility problems. And it's coupled with a relative stiffness problem.
Okay.
So all of that became, now in neuroscience too, they were actually looking at stiffness issues, not at all in the same way, but as set points for the nervous system. But it kind of put the idea of a stiffness issue in my mind. And I'm using stiffness not for the combination of active and passive tension, but just passive tension, because all muscles have some passive tension. And that's what, in some way, is supposed to hold us still. With hypertrophy, we get stiffer.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way it's supposed to work. So to then get to the point about the neuromuscular things, it's number one is, so we have this thing we called a kinesiopathologic model, because, and this goes to the sometimes comment that you made,
mm-hmm.
I'm well convinced, and I think Linda Van Dillen's research is supporting this very strongly, that musculoskeletal pain is a lifestyle issue. It starts early and just continues to grow. It's like almost every other health issue these days. You find out that bit by bit, your body's adapting movement patterns that injure your joints. Mm-hmm. It's progressive. And I've always been struck by the fact that if you want to find a musculoskeletal problem, you go to athletes. And then you find out it's not because they're hitting one another. They're running down a field and boom, there goes the knee, or boom, there goes something. It's what you do changes tissues just like it's supposed to do. But it doesn't mean it's right. It just means it's a change to adapt to the activity. Your body doesn't say, here, I've got this perfect template in mind and I'm going to follow that template. Mm-hmm. It adapts to the activity that you do, which is usually not optimal. And you get stuck with that pattern. So, and it doesn't even matter whether you're an athlete or not, because even if you sit at a desk, the way you rotate, the way you sit, lean to one side, sit on the edge of your chair or sit way back, you're constantly changing tissues. And the body tries to be efficient, not right, just efficient for that activity until you get an injury. So that's sort of has boiled down to where we are, is that these little changes that take place set up a path of least resistance for movement. Mm-hmm. And it's reflected. And so that, to me, Matt, is what's so exciting for us as physical therapists. It's because we're the people that can treat cause rather than consequence. We're the people that can help to take away the cause rather than treat the symptoms.
Right. Yes. I think that's part of our, I would say, a main role in what you, however you want to call it, preventative medicine, or you kind of mentioned that before, preventative. I mean, we should be at the forefront for prevention, all that centers around how people move.
Exactly. And that's what I'm saying, that the way Linda's research has supported this is that she's really shown that if you change the way people move, that their pain is related to that, and that if you change the way they move, they get better. They get better than just trying to do exercises, strengthening or stretching exercise. I think anything that changes a pattern makes people better. I think that's why there's so many studies that say, if you get a new mattress, if you go to an amusement park, your back pain gets better. Yeah. Because seriously, there are papers that publish that.
I believe you.
And it's because you've changed a pattern, but have you really gotten to the issue? Is this a temporary change, just like when you have acute pain and you modify how you move or how you walk? Plus, when the pain goes away, you don't go back to the right to a right pattern.
Correct.
That's why treating symptoms is not very effective, because you're still stuck with what caused it in the first place. So, and I'm just going to make one other thing, and then that even though I started off with this big background and major interest in the nervous system, and we'll call it motor control, I never really, on the way to developing some kind of expertise in musculoskeletal problems, thought that that was the major issue. But I can tell you that the longer I have played in this, the more I 100% believe it's a major issue. Now, I'm not personally in favor of using the term motor control. And the reason for that, Matt, is because those adaptations in muscle set up a loop so that if the muscles didn't adapt the way they do, the motor control wouldn't be the big issue. Let's do it this way. People that have, for example, poor abdominal muscles, it's often because they use their hamstrings instead of their abdominal muscles to control pelvic tilt.
Okay.
And knowing that you really have to, the adaptation in your hamstrings are ones that make the hamstrings readily recruited. And the weakness in your abdominals keeps them from being recruited.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
You see so that's what I'm saying is, I'll give you another example that may be even clearer.
No, I mean, that's perfectly clear to me. I completely understand what you're saying there.
Well, let me give you another one that's so pertinent to today's issues.
Okay.
And that's that now that we have put such a focus on coring the core and intensive exercise, I've seen more problems because people's abdominals are overdeveloped rather than underdeveloped.
Mm.
And when they're so overdeveloped, two things happen. They, I call it, they get squeezo-smasho. Because abdominal muscles don't just flex you or rotate you or keep you from rotating, but they also have a compressive force. That's the good news. That's a stabilizing. But that compressive force gets to be too much. And then those people, particularly men, get a kyphosis, and then they sway back.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when they sway back, they make the abdominals their anti-gravity muscle.
Mm.
So they're constantly on. So if you looked at somebody in this sway back, overdeveloped abdominal alignment, if you give them a weight to pick up, they'll sway back and use their abdominals to hold that weight rather than their back extensors.
Okay.
Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's you develop a muscle, it creates a loop, it says, I'm going to recruit you because you work best. I'm not going to go to these other muscles that aren't used to doing anything. And so then you set up the cycle so the good keep getting gooder and the poor keep getting poor. So that's why I think people need to not just think, oh, the nervous system's sending some signal downstream and that's what's doing it. No, it's the adaptations in the periphery that bias the activation in the nervous system.
So what do you mean by that? The adaptations in the periphery bias the nervous system?
That the here's these abdominals, like the example I'm giving you. You sway back, and they're the anti-gravity muscle. The overdevelopment of the abdominal muscles. I'm not going to throw around receptors because you could say, well, the proprioceptors, muscle spindles, are sending information up that change the threshold. I'm not going to do that because what I know about the nervous system is nobody knows enough, and as soon as they think they do, they're in trouble.
Correct.
But I'm just saying that you look at the muscles that are overdeveloped and you find out, and in fact, I think even Paul Hodges has sort of said this, he hasn't put it in a publication, that you kind of lower the threshold for activation.
Okay.
And that's what I think is the case. The body wants to be efficient, so it uses those that work the best, and it bypasses the ones that don't work good. It's just like people that are in a sway back posture with the upper back swayed back, they have diminished gluteal development. Why? Because the line of gravity is so far behind the hip joint, they don't need the gluteal muscles.
Good point.
Well, so that's why they go. So you don't do things then that use gluteal muscles. You're going to use your hamstrings more because you've taken them out of the circuit.
Well, and that all that.
No, it is nervous system. Yeah.
Yeah. All that you're mentioning makes me think about something that I've heard another person say, and I don't know your personal thoughts on, you know, what he has to say, but Gray Cook, the physical therapist. You know, I've heard him say before, you know, train movement, or essentially saying something like train movement, not muscles.
I totally agree with him.
And I think that's a wonderful thing.
But you are training the muscles to do the movement. There's no two ways around that.
Oh, of course. But you're not trying to isolate a specific muscle group or anything. You're trying to ingrain a movement pattern. And if they perform the movement pattern correctly, then the correct muscles will be trained appropriately the way they're supposed to.
I will modify that. So one of my dilemmas has been just exactly the point you're bringing up right now.
Okay.
It's like, here are people doing, I'm so impressed with, in fact, I'm a little worried about the intensity with which people are doing some of the activities these days. The dilemma was exactly what you said. If you can do all of these high intensity activities and you're kind of moving in the big world correctly, does that mean you're using all the right muscles? And I'm going to actually tell you, no, that we have so many ways, and that unless you do the little bitty assessments of things, I mean, we could talk about how many ways there are to do a motion that looks like hip abduction.
Mm-hmm.
Are to have the manifestation of hip abduction. But if you aren't looking very specifically at the activation patterns, you may miss when some other muscle is too dominant.
Okay. I completely agree with that.
Okay. So I'm saying it's yes, you train the movement, but I want an assessment of the little bitty movements. Well, how exactly do you try to hold your hip in abduction, as well as how do you actually rotate? Are your abdominals too good and you twist in the thoracic spine? I want to look at those patterns, as well as I want to look at how you move out in the real world.
Okay.
but I totally agree. I think one of the ironies of my life is that from what I know, this kind of material is bigger among the strength and conditioning people than physical therapists. And I think, and I think the irony, when I've never said lift a weight, and I think the irony is because of that point you just made, and that Greg Cook means that you have to train the movement, and making muscles stronger didn't make people move better.
Right. And I think a similar person on the West Coast, Kelly Starrett, he's a physical therapist, but he's, you know, same kind of thing, arguably more well-known in the strength and conditioning community. I don't know if he talks about the same exact thing, but he has a similar point of view, I think.
Yeah. Well, I think anybody that's done work in that field for a long period of time knows it.
Yeah. Yeah. We were saying again before we started recording, I was one of the reasons why I was hoping to talk to you is, you know, my background is as a manual physical therapist. I can do a lot of different things with the human body with my hands, but in the end, it really comes down to changing how people move. And sure, there's some things that I could do manually with my hands, but sometimes I don't need to. And the more I practice over the years, the more I'm learning that there's a lot of things I don't need to do with my hands if I facilitate how somebody moves in a different way, or, you know, whether that's through exercise or PNF or other things.
Well, I know I've been accused of kind of being in the hands off, but I'm not. I have my hands all over everybody.
Oh, of course.
And I think this is an important point, Matt. It's me. There were many wonderful things that manipulative and manual therapy contributed to the profession. The bad thing to me was it was passive.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like the therapist had to move the joint, but you can take those same hands and learn about the tissues, not just whether the joint moves are right. And you can also use it for muscle reeducation.
Exactly.
And so I have my hands on people because I can feel what happens, and I can also teach them what to do. Like trying to teach somebody how to move their scapula correctly, you have to have your hands on them. You got to feel, where does it stop when the humerus is moving? You've got to know exactly how all that works. And that's an accessory motion. So nobody is knowing what they're feeling unless you're really teaching them that.
Mm-hmm.
So I agree, but I think having your hands on people is a central part of the examination and the treatment of the patient.
Amen to that. So have you ever had any particular training or exposure to something like PNF? I know.
Oh my God. I knew Maggie Knott. I mean, she came in and had me do a pattern.
So I know that's probably a saying PNF in air quotes of saying that's probably a very broad term, and you can define it in many ways. But is that something that, you know, going through patterns of movement like the diagonal patterns or spiral patterns, things like that, is that something that you utilize or
no.
Are you? Okay.
No.
So can you talk about your kind of your history with that, or how you might not use that or how you might use that?
Well, I was never convinced that, in fact, PNF was like the only thing. There was the Bobas and the PNF, and people, you know, in the early it came out of the neurological patient.
Correct.
And I was just never convinced that with my experience that trying to do patterns like that was useful. And one of the things that also kind of undid me with PNF was that supposedly you were inhibiting the muscle by the contract relax method. I found the contract relax was sort of useful, but then the explanation was you're inhibiting the muscle and that's why it works. And it never made sense to me because inhibition lasts 50 milliseconds and you had to be pretty fast for that. What made more sense to me was a mechanical explanation that when you contract the muscle, it shortens. And then when it shortens, it pulls on the tendon. And then you're stretching the tendon rather than just pulling on muscle, which already gives too readily.
Okay.
So the mechanical aspects made more. And I just, set home with me as a very useful thing, as such. So I'm not into those patterns. I'm into the patterns that people use when they move, move their joints in a more traditional way.
Okay. So would that be any different though, as a general concept, like you were talking about having your hands on and assessing the way somebody moves, like the scapula, for example, what you were saying?
Yeah, but I'd have them do shoulder flexion.
Okay. And so while they're,
when they're doing shoulder flexion, I'm monitoring with my hand, with my finger actually at first, as the arm goes up. So I put one finger at the distal humerus, and as they're raising their arm up, I'm tracing the path of the scapula. And then in those people where I see it stop, for example, then I'll have them face the wall, elbows flexed, and just kind of slide their hands up the wall, and I'll move the scapula, trying to move it like it should move kinesiologically. So mm-hmm. I'm imposing. And then what do I know? I can feel if it's hard to do. Like if there's real resistance to moving that scapula, is that because the rhomboids are so stiff? Is it because they're also kind of contracting the trapezius too much? And it's pulling, it's keeping it from moving out into abduction. You know, you've got this real fine timing between the serratus trying to abduct and upwardly rotate and the rhomboids and the trapezius trying to keep it adducted. And they have to do their job well, or the trapezius isn't, I mean, or the serratus isn't very effective.
Right.
See, so I know whether there's resistance to that. I know whether it goes easily. I know whether the scapula won't move at all, or it stops halfway to where it should go. So all of those things are giving me information about what's the underlying condition for this patient, rather than some kind of pattern that I can't, I don't know what all is going on. I like the more specific assessment of what each individual muscle is contributing or not contributing.
Okay. So would it be fair to say you're looking more at, I wouldn't say tasks, but you know, just movements.
I mean, they're the basic movements, flexion,
life.
Right? Flexion in the shoulder. You know, in fact, there's a nice paper now by Rebecca Lawrence, who's a PhD student who did her PhD with Paula Ludwig, who's I consider the best shoulder researcher, and about, you know, the impingement happens really lower down, up to between 0 and 60 degrees of flexion, and flexion's much safer than abduction because you get the supraspinatus tendon out of the way faster. It's not as dangerous as abduction. So I like to watch flexion until I think it's performed correctly. I don't mm-hmm. look at abduction. Lateral rotation is critical, and I want to know whether it's mostly the posterior deltoid or the deep lateral rotators, which you mm-hmm. can tell by how the elbow extends. So I'm looking at more traditional muscles in more traditional movements. And then it's the whole, how the whole limbs are functioning.
Okay.
Is that clear at all, or is that?
Yes, no, it's perfectly clear.
Oh, okay.
I'm just thinking.
Let me give you another example. Like people with these hip problems, even FAI and other things, if they sit and do knee extension, some of them will get hip medial rotation while they're just sitting and doing knee extension. Well, that shouldn't happen. So, or if you put them up in a hip abduction test and they flex and medially rotate, that shouldn't happen. It tells you that they're not using the right muscles. If you want to test the iliopsoas in sitting and they get a cramp and their hip medially rotates, they're not using their iliopsoas. So yeah. It's all of those things that tell me about everyday movements that the muscle strategy isn't optimal.
Yeah, that's, I 100% agree with that, because I've seen similar things in the clinic here, maybe assessing in a different way, but I've seen that a bunch, and it's just, it's coming up in my brain and my head a lot more when I'm assessing patients, that however they're choosing to move, whether you want to call it a choice or not, whatever's ingrained into their body.
Yep.
It's so many things that for patients that come into the clinic for whatever reason, it's just faulty. It's not correct.
However, that's, you want to,
call it.
You've nailed it. That's the whole issue. Just because you're doing it doesn't mean you're doing it right.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you know, just because you're wearing a muscle doesn't mean you're using it. Yeah.
Can we switch gears for just a moment?
Of course.
So kind of going back to some history, at least, can you talk a little bit about, where you're from, where you grew up, and what that kind of life was like for you?
That's a very short story.
That's fine.
Because I was born in St. Louis, and I still live here. I always say my parents had to move away because I wasn't going. and it's all Washington University's fault. I went there for an undergraduate degree, and in those days it was 2 years in undergraduate training, and then you went the last 2 years to get your physical therapy BS in physical therapy, and that's what happened. I went to Washington University. I had a whole 18 students in my class, and I always like this to point out, because it's nobody even understands it these days. The majority of my classmates, and they were all girls, of course, and we were girls. We weren't even women. We were girls. were there for their MRS degree. And the hunting was good because there were medical students and dental students at the time. And of course, the dental students were all white Anglo-Saxon males. I just read the list of all the graduating medical students from Washington University, and I'll tell you, there's barely a good old Anglo-Saxon name in the group. It's just, oh my God, it's so different.
Yeah.
Anyway, the other thing that was so different is these days you get an early admit to PT school if you've had two ACLs, and in my day we had. When Maggie Knott was there and we did straight leg raises for about 10 minutes, three girls couldn't come to class the next day because they were so sore. it was such the opposite of today's people. But anyway, so I graduated then from Washington University, and I actually a classmate of mine found me a job. What was probably the second best physical therapy department in the city at the time. And it was about 3/4 of a mile away from Washington University. And that was kind of an interesting story because the therapists there were very experienced. But one of them had been in the Navy. She was a Navy nurse and then became a physical therapist. And so they were all very substantial, knowledgeable people. And the facility was called Deaconess Hospital, actually hired a physiatrist who came in to tell people what to do. Oh my God, that was a mistake on his part.
Didn't go over too well.
Well, within 1 year, everybody was gone. and I was very lucky. See, also, you have to realize that the path of physical therapy has followed the money, meaning that we have grown as a profession because we made money. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that was happening is that there was these Hill Burton funds to build rehab centers. And that was in the 1950s, the late 1950s. So Washington University, not to pass up any funds, built a kind of a rehab center. It never turned out to be full blown, but it was 4 floors of a facility that was to be a rehab center. It was named a rehab center. And then the physical therapy service had belonged to Barnes Hospital, but Washington University, in its monetary sense, then took over the physical therapy service to put it into this rehab facility. That's what the Department of Preventive Medicine was going to run. And so then they needed therapists, and I was very lucky because I was recruited back to be part of that rehab center. And that's sort of the beginning and the end of it, because I worked there, and I knew I needed to be in a situation where people would ask me questions, smart young kids coming around, and be in an environment where there was constant learning and opportunities to learn. And even though there were only 3 faculty members, one of them was sort of working on her PhD, which was highly atypical at the time. And she set sort of an a target for me, a mentorship role, I guess is fair to say. Mm-hmm. And since she let me participate in the teaching in the anatomy lab and help her with the clinical, arranging clinical practice and having students, just furthered my wanting to desire to learn. You know, I quite honestly was more interested in understanding the patient's problems than I was truly treating the patient. That doesn't mean I didn't do a good job or anything. It's just I was intrigued by trying to understand what was going on. Mm-hmm. And so that's the end of the story. I was there. I guess it's said that I had many jobs in one place. As I mentioned before, I worked as a staff physical therapist. I became assistant chief for 9 years. And then because I was in constant argument with the physicians and I about how to treat stroke patients, and I knew I didn't really know what I was doing. I was lucky enough to get a PhD, and I got my PhD there. They were just starting a neurobiology program, and so I was one of three people they took in. And after I reversed my cerebral atrophy, which took a little bit, I was able to get through the program. And then they hired me on there to be this coordinator of basic sciences, never to leave again until 2012. So I retired at age 75. And I was happily getting a chance to do everything, patient care, teaching, and research. I have to admit that I've been not the world's best researcher at all. I think I was... more empirical. I liked figuring out the problems, but not doing all the hard work to put them in place and kind of theory building and being fortunate enough to work with other people that like Linda Van Dillen, who's, I call it separating fact from fiction with her, with her research, but it's totally true.
Okay.
And the others, I'm sort of proud that the theories are sort of holding up for the most part. I mean, things have to go, but right. For the most part, they're holding up. So my life is very boring. It's true. Marshall University, I think there were some advantages by sort of staying in one place. I wanted to understand more about what I was doing instead of going to different places to see different things. It worked out.
How did you first become interested in being a physical therapist? I mean, back
when it was a polio. You know, I mean, you're all these little paralyzed kids, and I loved playing sports and being out and about, and what could be more pitiful than a little paralyzed child? As it turned out, I hated pediatrics, but that was my motivation. I also sometimes wonder myself, because like neither one of my parents even went to high school. Why I so readily pursued college in this, but I think it was the appeal of that. It was certainly not a time where I thought anything about becoming a physician. It was not for women. It was certainly not for me. I mean, it just didn't seem like the kind of world I could be in. And that was one of the advantages of being at Washington University. I found out that not every PhD was a Einstein and that there was an opportunity for me to go that way.
Okay.
Just by breaks. So it was that. And then the intrigue of trying to understand patients' problems. I think one of the things I think has been not so great about the profession. We've clearly had most of the students come into the program. I'd say easily 50% could be in medical schools. I mean, PTs are so bright and so committed. In fact, the only thing that would scare me to go into the classroom after serving on the admissions committee, because it's like, they're so much smarter than I am. Oh my God, how am I going to deal with this? Well, I'm older and I'll act smart. Anyway, is that we dumb down to practice. And it's part of it is this profession thing. We got focused on treating symptoms. You know, in the old days, I don't know how long you've been out, Matt, but we had prescriptions, and PT departments would send out blank pads for people to check off what they should do for the patient, you know, ultrasound, mm-hmm. E-stim, active exercise, passive exercise, and physicians were supposed to check those off.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's like, you tell me what to do, and I know more about it than you do.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it was like we we played that game, and we never came forth to let him know we were figuring things out. I thought I would never say a kind word about a physiatrist, because they would come down and get all the information from us and then go talk to the other physicians like they're the ones that knew it. Well, they didn't know anything if we hadn't told them everything. I mean, it's totally true. You know, yeah. Now they're some of my best friends because they're the orthopedic medicine people. And mm-hmm. and some of them are learning very quickly that, you know, they can take care of the consequences, but we're the ones that take care of the symptoms and trying to save people from surgery. So the story is I was there with a lot of breaks and a lot of people that set good examples and opportunities for me to grow and to do my thing of trying to understand better. So the profession, to me, needs to do more. See, for example, you know, I teach a lot of courses, and people want to know, like, how many reps for how many times. Well, that's not the important thing. It's like, what is the problem? What are we treating? How does it respond? People don't know muscles anymore, what they do. They don't think about muscle biology. And we should be understanding the problem and coming up with a diagnosis and then how to treat it. I always say the difference between a novice and an expert is pattern recognition.
Oh, big time.
And that's what it is. You've been in this long enough. I could walk into a stroke patient's room after 9 years, and I knew whether they were going to recover or not. Now, did I bother to tell anybody? Of course not. That was sort of my secret. But it was a whole classification idea. Now, Patty Sheets has done things with that, and she's working with the neurosection to get them to make diagnosis. But still, our emphasis is what therapy can I do instead of what's the diagnosis of this condition so I know the most appropriate modality to choose. And modality meaning not a physical agent, but what kind of intervention should is the most appropriate for this person. So yeah, that's why, to me, manual therapy also undermined itself by calling itself manual therapy rather than what they were trying to do was to figure out the problem and give it a diagnosis. Now, if you go to Australia, they say they're diagnosing. Then I say, show me the list. Tell me what the names are. And nobody does. So to me, that's the big mistake we've made is we're not using diagnostic labels to guide our treatment. We're jumping in there and looking for isolated things to say, well, this needs treatment. And it's like, oh, the hamstrings are too short. That must be the problem. Well, that's crazy. It's not the problem. So that's what I mean is really smart people, really well educated. And in fact, there's a little mea culpa on my part too, because I pushed as hard as I possibly could to get us to the clinical doctorate level, but I do not believe anybody looks at current graduates as doctors.
Oh yeah. I mean, it's.
See, so you're $100,000 in debt, 7 years of education. Yeah. You got a doctoral label, but nobody's looking at you that way. Well, why?
And I don't know. I think that to me, I don't know how I'd word it. It's not like I have a particular issue with it because I think we should be, you know, at a doctorate level education, but at the same time, what you're saying, nobody looking at us that way. I mean, you're coming out, like you said, with a ton of debt. And, you know, when you come out of school, you're not going to be making as much money. Yeah. And you're very well educated, but you know, what does that get you?
See, and
now we're talking into more of politics and other realms, but.
Well, it's not just politics. It's practice. Now, why is that important, Matt? It's important because we just said we could treat cause, but who knows it? Who's coming to us for cause? Nobody.
Yeah.
And I think, and what I was going to go on to say is all you have to do is ask yourself, why does anybody go to a doctor? I go to my doctor to get a diagnosis.
Yeah.
And if we don't have those, we're also not telling people that we know about the cause. Now, there are some physicians, that, you know, in fact, the physician that Paula Ludwig works with, who says, you know, that there's not such a thing as shoulder impingement because that means you're supposed to shave down the clavicle, but that it's the way you move. And so they're much more into this, it's the movement causing the problem, but how are we telling people that? We're not.
Yeah.
Do you see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So this kind of growing up in the profession, I saw it when I wanted the physician to tell me what to do. I thought all I needed was to know enough not to get anybody in trouble. And I thought I was a medical cheerleader. All I had to be was enthusiastic and help them, drag them down the hall. You know, come on, you can move, let's do it. Yeah. I never thought I'd have to figure out anything. Well, it became clear with the neurological patient, I soon was able to pick up a hemiplegic. I didn't need anybody to tell me they were paralyzed on one side. I was real swift that way. But doggone, they couldn't tell me anything about why they didn't move right, other than they had a lesion in their brain. Well, I figured that one out too.
Yeah.
So, you know, it just has become so clear what we can do, but we're handicapped by still living in a model that's 100 years old.
Yeah. Yeah. And I know
we've changed internally, but we haven't changed externally. And we haven't changed internally enough.
Yeah. And I know that's, you know, I'm sure it changes depending on the leadership, but, you know, or associations like the APTA and other things trying to change public perception or even fellow healthcare communities' perception of what physical therapists are or can do. And I'm not involved with all that, so I don't know all the troubles they have of dealing with it, but I know that's still a huge issue, like you're saying.
Well, and the problem is, even if the APTA got to say, well, go see the physical therapist for cause, how many are going to know what to do?
Exactly. And that's one thing too, that I think is a difficulty, because like any profession, you have some that are really swift and really smart and great at what they do. And then you have some that are horrible. I mean, just flat out, let's just say it, like they're not very good at what they do. And then there's a lot in between.
Well, and the other thing, Matt, is the forces working these days, because people are getting squeezed for more productivity.
Yes.
Because the dollar is getting short. I haven't talked to hardly any private practitioners where they don't say cost is going up and income's going down.
Every year.
And so, you know, how long can you sustain that model if you aren't looking at a different business model based on a different practice model?
Yeah.
So,
well, surely.
So I'm incredibly enthusiastic about what the profession is this 60 odd years later. And I know what we could do for society and healthcare costs. I do say that with tongue in cheek, because I know people still smoke. And I know that now that we know lifestyle and obesity is like really unhealthy, we have 40% obesity in this country.
Yeah.
But at least there's the fighting chance. I always like think of the dental model, and people do go off to the dentist twice a year to make sure they're brushing their teeth, and you only use them for speaking and eating. And we need our whole body for everything. And I'm also a little bit encouraged, because I keep hearing more and more on the radio and various sources. Radio, you remember that? That sitting is the new cancer, is the new smoking.
I mean, oh, yeah, yeah.
Sitting is the new, So that's our chance. If we jump on that, yes, we want you to move, but we're going to be the people that keep you moving and not hurting.
Mm-hmm.
Ride that bandwagon, get more demonstration of that, have diagnosis for the conditions that support the idea that it is the way you move that causes these problems. And you know, we should be aided and abetted by the opiate crisis. But again, I'll tell you this really sad story. You got time for one more story?
Oh, of course.
Okay. So the one more story, I'll never forget this because it made me so nauseous. I'm listening on my radio, and they're interviewing a physician who's on one of the major committees for the AMA to help physicians stop prescribing opioids. And she said, we have to have physicians recognize those patients that can be treated by other modalities like cold packs, physical therapy, yoga.
Oh, God. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, we're right in there with cold packs, yoga. See, they see us as somehow helping people with their symptoms, but not figuring out the problem. Helping people with their symptoms in a symptomatic relief rather than a causative relief, you know?
Yep.
So that's why I'm so head up. I worry about the business model. I don't see it coming where we're going to have a big inflow of cash like we had with Public Law 9142 or with Medicare. I see more of the Balanced Budget Acts of 1997.
Yeah.
And that wreaked havoc on us. So anyway, that's why I'm glad people like you are trying to get different messages out about the importance of what physical therapies should be doing for people and how.
Well, thank you. One of the things I wanted to ask you at some point, as long as we still have time, is with all the different things that you've learned and studied over the years, what are some of the most impressive things that you've learned or, you know, are continuing to learn about the nervous system or the neuromuscular system? Like, has there been any kind of groundbreaking things that altered the course of your way of practicing that you've learned over the years? And I know we've already talked about a bunch of it, but any specifics at all?
No, I think in some ways, talking about these things of old, and I just read an article that I thought, oh goodness, is that it used to be before that people would talk about 1A afferents and group 2s doing all these things. They had all these specifics laid out for the nervous system. And as I kind of mentioned before, I spent enough time learning about the nervous system that I know nobody knows. Yeah. And you can't get that specific. And I think in many ways, it's better not to try to explain something because you lose your credibility when you go into those kinds of explanations. I think that's why in some ways I keep it general. But to me, the thing that I've learned the most as I told you, is that I do realize how important the nervous system is to the musculoskeletal world. I can't remember what year it was. It had to be in the 1980s that there was a piece published in the journal, and it was I could think of her name, but it was about patients with shoulder pain, and that they had excessive elevation of the shoulder of the scapula, the whole shoulder girdle, when they did flexion.
Yep.
And that they continued, I'm bringing this up as an example, they continued to do that after the pain was gone. Well, the article was about 5 pages, and there was a dialogue going on between the editor and other people for 6 pages saying, do you think the nervous system plays a role in musculoskeletal disorders? You're like, I about fell apart laughing. Yes, it does.
yeah, obviously.
And I think that's again things that people, you know, you get a referral and you got 6 visits to take the pain away, so to speak. But after the pain goes away, people still don't move right. You know, not only did they move wrong to get the pain, but the adaptations that they made for the pain don't just go away. We don't have an internal template of here's perfect. So I can tell if I come to California, people that do that their water board. I mean, what do you call that when you go out on the water on a surfboard? Boogie foot it, mm-hmm. because that leg behaves differently than the leg and back behaves differently than the leg in front. When you just have them lying down and move their leg, I can tell people that lift a lot of weights because it's very hard to passively flex their hip and knee because they're used to having all the muscles come on all at the same time. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
The nervous system has set up these patterns. It's the critical issue.
Yeah.
It's the critical issue. And that's what's so important. It is a neuromusculoskeletal system.
And my mind's going in so many different directions with what you're saying. I mean, all the different neurological adaptations that people go through based on their habitual movements.
Yep.
I mean, you hear a lot about it nowadays or in the past, I don't know, however many years, 5 years or more, I'm sure, of for kids in that they're emphasizing don't specialize in one sport too early.
I think they're quite right.
Yeah, and to me it makes a whole bunch of sense because they're adapting their body to just one or a few different movement patterns.
But if they saw a physical therapist every year or twice a year, that physical therapist could show them how not to do that.
Exactly, because even then, how many of those kids, when they do one sport or they do try and specialize, how many of them are performing those movement patterns correctly?
That's exactly right. Oh, you are so right. I've gone on the internet because I've done some talks for the pediatric groups, and I just pull up pictures of groups of kids exercising, and it's appalling the alignments that their bodies are in. It's my gosh, it's scary.
Yeah, it's and that's the funny thing is getting back to the prevention side.
Right.
If we're going to truly be preventative, we should probably be getting a hold of these kids before they even get to kindergarten.
Well, I'm you know, you start seeing the dentist when you get your teeth. I think we should be lifespan practitioners. People should come in for yearly exams, and if they're going to change, take on a new sport or a new activity. We also need to identify structural variations so that they don't do things they shouldn't do. If you have femoral antiversion, ballet is not in your future.
Yeah, that's a good point.
You have genu valgus, you don't want to run marathons. You can run 6 miles, but you're not going to run marathons.
Yeah.
I mean, so all these structural variation things are just huge. Yeah. Oh, I couldn't agree with you more, Matt. Yeah. I think that's where our future is, but I think people have to understand that we don't just do therapy, but we figure out the problem. I mean, that label of therapy is kind of an unfortunate thing. Even the speech people have labeled themselves speech pathologists, not speech therapist anymore.
Yeah. And if I can kind of change directions a little bit.
Yep, sure.
I'm kind of curious of your thoughts, and I think I have an understanding of what you might say, but I just want to hear you talk about it just for a little bit. The difference of, on a neurological level, facilitation versus inhibition. So if you're used to moving in one particular way, and let's say that whatever that is incorrect, it would facilitate, you know, certain muscle groups to be firing more dominantly than others. And so the ones that are being fired more dominantly or activated more than they need to be become overly facilitated, and the antagonists to those groups become inhibited. Is that...
I'll tell you the truth. If I were you, I'd never use the words facilitated and inhibited.
Okay, so that's... I thought you would say that, and I was...
I am going to say that.
I was hoping that you could explain your thoughts behind that or why.
Why I say that?
Yes.
Well, because facilitation in times of old really meant that you were activating 1A receptors. There were certain groups that the type 2 endings would, like for flexion reflexes, and if you activate those, that will make certain muscles respond through the type 2 endings, and then you have reciprocal innervation, and you have Golgi tendon organs. Nobody knows how in the hell those work. And to dress it up with those fancy labels to me just means you don't know what you're talking about. If you just say that the gluteals are not well developed and they're delayed, and you're watching somebody move and they don't have good muscle definition, so they're using their hamstrings instead of their glute muscles. You don't have to dress it up with the glutes are inhibited. Well, are they inhibited or they just don't work because they're not working against gravity? Then you're safe. Nobody's going to look at you and say, "What in the hell does he think he's saying anyway?" And it's you know, I'm going to actually send you on email a couple pictures of some medical students that who we just totally changed their alignment by just doing quadruped rocking. You have to make people aware about their alignment and how they're working. I can't emphasize enough this whole thing about working against gravity. Mm-hmm. Because some muscles have to do too much. Like if you're in a sway back posture and posterior tilt, your iliopsoas can cause a stress fracture of your lesser trochanter because it's holding you up when you should be using your hip extensors as well as doing swing phase. So if you've got a big backpack on or you're running a marathon, you can get a stress fracture if you're walking in that kind of alignment.
Okay.
So it's you don't need the fancy neurological terms. You just need to look at the muscles and whether they're participating appropriately or not. But, and then teach people to do it otherwise.
So is there any, and I know you said, you know, nobody truly knows what's going on, but is there any better explanation that you would give?
I don't need one.
Okay. So you're just focusing more on what the muscles are able to do or are not able to do.
Yeah. I wasn't going to go through these details, but one of the reasons why this neurologist took me on as a graduate, a PhD student, is he had gone to this great big conference where all of the physical therapy gurus were coming to explain their neurological treatments. The Bobas were there. The husband, Berta, was the really smart one, and she was the therapist. And her husband, Carl, was a neurologist, a really bad neurologist. And the people were there for the PNF people and the, I can't remember.
NDT or other things.
Neurodevelopmental treatment. Yeah.
Yep.
No, NDT is Bobath's.
Okay.
Anyway, okay. So they get up and then Carl starts to explain the facilitation inhibition and all that. And this neurologist who took me on got up and said, crap, nonsense, ridiculous. You don't know what in the hell you're talking about. in front of the whole group, as he would. So, I mean, this guy, if it would have just been Berta showing what she did, they would say, I wonder what's happening. But when Carl got up to explain it in ways that everybody knows you can't explain, all credibility was gone. The focus was gone. So when I went into, and happily I bebopped into his office probably not a month after this, and he said, I'll take you on. Somebody's got to straighten out those physical therapists. So I'm forever grateful that, you know, that they gave those stupid explanations. It's like, why do it? It's not necessary. And you lose your credibility. I mean, that was one thing Florence did well. Because in some ways, it's too long, or long is weak and short is strong, wasn't totally off. And considering somebody who, they didn't even know what muscle physiology was when she was learning things, it's because it doesn't have enough stiffness at the right length. And the stiffness is related to strength. She just couldn't quite get the, we agreed to disagree about some things, but
yeah,
but that was fine tuning. But Florence didn't put down things that you could just say, that is a stupid old lady. I mean, she was very, very good about that. And it's better not to say than to give an explanation that's too far afield.
Yeah. Okay. That's a good point.
And you don't need it. You don't need it.
Shirley, one person that I've heard, and I don't know if it's justified or not, that I've heard also used whenever your name comes up is Vladimir Yonda.
Oh yeah. Right. That's right.
Did you have any influence from his work?
No, okay. No, because I knew anatomy better than he did. Yonda was the only other, he was the only other person talking about the nervous system. I mean, I wasn't talking. He was talking long before I was. And, you know, he was a Czechoslovakian physician. I don't know whether you know that much about him.
I did know that.
In fact, I'll tell you another great story. And actually, where he started getting some claim to fame was when he went to Australia. And where, of course, as you know, is the home of the manipulative manual therapist, Maitland being the big guy, but he wasn't, and he was, where Gwen Paul and Paul Hodges were, Brisbane, up in Brisbane. And he did some work with a Margaret, whose name I can't remember right this minute. And he started talking about, musculoskeletal pain being nervous system disorders, but he really thought that you were a minor CP if you had disordered motor control. And then he did these big patterns of phasic and tonic muscles, which was like two phasic and two tonic. And then he jumped on the developmental sequence thing, sort of like with the Bobas. But it was, again, too many generalization about phasic and tonic muscles. It was too much about development and this whole thing that you had a kind of a minor cerebral palsy if you had a musculoskeletal problem. And he really didn't know his anatomy very well. I mean, he didn't know what the rhomboids did, etc. So, but he was at least making people think about the nervous system and musculoskeletal disorders. So the the person that did research with him early on, real research with him, was Gwen Jahl. Do you know Gwen?
I've definitely heard. I don't know her personally, but I know who she is and her work.
Well, so that put her, the work she did with him was on muscles.
Okay.
And Gwen came to St. Louis and we recorded a lecture that she was giving to the orthopedic. So I'm not speaking out of school because this is on videotape. So when I'm interviewing Gwen and I said, Gwen, you were the world's best, most established manipulative therapist, trained by Maitland himself. She's the only one I know who pushed on a vertebrae. They did a CAT scan or something and said, yes, that's the right vertebrae.
Yeah.
So she's a superstar. What made you start studying muscles? And she said it was OPSP. I said, Gwen, what in the world is OPSP? She's, well, Gwen always had her own private practice. She said, well, my secretary would call and say, old patient, same problem. You know, and to me, that's the thing. I always wanted to know what made something go wrong and what were you going to do to keep it from going wrong again?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where the movement and the specificity plays such a big role.
Okay. Gosh, you know, I'd love to.
So Yonda, you know, had his role, but there were just too many generalizations again. And he was very hard to understand because of his accent as well as his concepts.
Okay. There's so many different things that I'd love to keep chatting with you about because.
You know everything I know now.
Well, no, I don't think so. But there's so many different topics, you know, I'd want to dive deeper into. I don't think we'll have the time today, but I think all this has been really fascinating to sit and talk with you about, to learn your point of view. And I'd have to shamefully admit that I do not own your book, Movement Impairment Syndromes.
That's right. You can probably get a used copy for next to nothing now.
That has no bearing on the content, by the way. But,
yeah, no, well, I'm supposed to be working on the second edition. That's actually why I retired. And I'm really, you're going to make me feel super guilty because I've been so slow in getting it out. And, and you're right. There's nothing wrong with what's in the first edition, but we've got so much more evidence. In fact, when I wrote about the chapter on the hip, nobody was even thinking about FAI, et cetera. And I'm pretty happy with that. And we've redone the shoulder diagnosis. There's nothing wrong with it.
Yeah. So there's two books out, Diagnosis and Treatment of Movement Impairment Syndromes, and then the Movement System Impairment Syndromes of the Extremities, Cervical, and Thoracic Spines.
Right. That covers the, so the first book had the low back, the hip, and the shoulder. And Linda, all of Linda's research, you know, we got all that evidence now that's so good for the back. And Paula's work, too soon, old, too late, smart. I didn't even recognize the importance of scapular internal rotation. And now it's a big one of our diagnosis. So, So there are things that we've refined. The basic concepts I'm pretty proud of because I've said from that time, and I wrote in the late 1990s, was you got to change the way you do your everyday activities. They're the problem. That's what's got to change.
Yeah. Yeah, completely, heartfully agree to that. Well, hopefully, you know, if it's okay with you, I can try and chat with you again some other time and get some more questions answered because, you know, I find a lot of the stuff you're talking about fascinating and I want to be able to learn more about it. But between now and that next time, if that ever happens, you know, hopefully I'll be able to read your books and get a better understanding.
But, you know, if you don't want to have to go through the whole book and you want some general ideas, Matt, the WashU has a website where you can actually hear the introductory lecture at your leisure. It's a voiceover PowerPoint. And also the scapular diagnosis are there and the humeral ones and then some examples of physical exams.
Oh, okay. And is that easy to navigate to? Or
real, well, you go pt.wustl.edu, and then you go to education and continuing education and MSI, Movement System Impairment Syndromes. Yeah, it's pretty easy.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for that. Mm-hmm. Well, Shirley, do you have anything else that you'd like to add or talk about before
I think I've said everything that is on my wee little fading mind. No. We've gone from stem to stern, but hopefully it creates a picture of somebody who's strongly convinced and strongly committed to see what an amazing profession this is. And I wanted to have the recognition and manifestations that it's fully capable of. And there's some big steps that need to take place because I am worried about, I'm a Pollyanna by nature, and I am worried about the business model and in the future, because there's going to be forces working so hard to reduce healthcare costs. And I kind of say we're about quality of life, not quantity, though we do know it's quantity in the long haul.
Yeah.
And that's why I like to see things going really well, getting the recognition and delivering the kind of service that we're capable of.
Okay. Well, thank you so much
thank you, Matt, for giving me the opportunity. Today.
Yeah. I mean, it's been wonderful to get to speak with you. And like I said, hopefully in the future we can chat again and go over some different but related topics.
Fine and dandy. I'm retired, so I don't have anything to do.
I'm sure you're still quite busy.
I am. I'm so happy about that.
Yeah. Well,
you take care and thank you for calling.
Yes, thank you again. You have a wonderful day.
I will.
Bye-bye. Well, ladies and gentlemen, there you have it, Dr. Shirley Sarman. Hope you enjoyed that conversation. I certainly did. In fact, I want to have another conversation with her just to make sure that I fully understand her point of view and all the research that she's done. She's a great mind and has contributed a lot to the world of physical therapy. Obviously, she's a fellow of the APTA, so that just means that you do contribute a lot. So yeah, I hope you guys appreciated it. I certainly did. Please let me know if you have any thoughts or questions about this particular podcast. If I do get to talk with Dr. Sarman again in the future, is there anything in particular you'd like for me to ask her for us to discuss? You know, please let me know that as well. Otherwise, thank you guys for listening as always. Please check us out on the other things, the YouTube channel that we have, some fun things that I try to put up there that I think are unique in their presentation. And yeah, if there's anything else that you guys want to see or hear, then by all means, let me know. And otherwise, check us out on all the places that you find podcasts of Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and now Spotify.